So, class two. In class one, we learned that there are two ways to look at reality, right? Two ways to look at reality. And one of those ways is for normal people like us, deceptive. We see things and we think they exist one way when they do not exist that way. They do not exist in an unchanging way. They do not exist in an independent way, right? Things exist as changing things. Things exist as dependent things, interdependent with each other, which is why they have no self-nature. Self-nature is a technical term, right? Svabhava. And nothing has svabhava. Nothing has a self-nature, because if it had a self-nature, it wouldn't need anything else to be what it is. You see, it wouldn't depend on anything else. And you wouldn't depend on anybody else, and people also. So if we had a self-nature to our self, to our personality, to our sense of identity, we could exist, theoretically at least, independent of all of the beings, because we are who we are. But so it doesn't take much to figure out that that's not the case, right? You know, we're shaped by all kinds of forces. You know, our personalities are shaped by all kinds of interactions, you know, relationships that we have with other people, with experience, you know, time goes on, all kinds of things. All kinds of interactions that we have that make us who we are. And there's no us apart from that. There's no self apart from the interrelations that we have and have had with others. And so that is it's not that difficult, is it? At that level, it's just not that difficult to recognize, right? Intellectually. There's a strong feeling, however, that somebody's at home in there, right? Mm-hmm. Knock, knock.
Who's there?
Exactly. Who's there? And, you know, there's a sense that, well, there's somebody there. There's somebody in there. There's me. There's a me in there. And so one of the things that we'll be talking about in today's class is why that's impossible. How that is just got to be an illusion. We are deceived. We deceive ourselves. We deceive ourselves about ourselves. So that's one kind of reality. We call it deceptive reality because we're deceived by it. Not because it's deceiving, but because we're deceived by it. So then there's ultimate reality. Ultimate reality is the reality that mystics encounter when they're having their mystical experience. When the subject-object division, which seems so obviously to entail there's me and then there's the world, and we exist independently and then encounter each other. Two independent entities, me and the world and the people in the world, encounter each other. When that subject-object distinction breaks down, or seems to break down, that is the mystical experience. And so you can read about it in all kinds of traditions: Christian mystics, the Sufis, Hindus, Buddhists, you know, all kinds of mystics from all kinds of traditions and all times and places have said, like, usually said a couple of things about their experience. Number one, they say, I can't talk about it. Nothing I can say about it. It transcends language. So then they revert to metaphor. It's like rivers that run into the ocean. Yeah? It's like salt. This is from the Upanishads. It's like salt that dissolves into water. In other words, they feel a sense of oneness. A sense of oneness. And when you feel a sense of oneness, it can't be you who's feeling the sense of oneness. You can't say, I am feeling oneness. Huh? You is oneness. You just merge into the oneness. And so that's what they mean by the subject-object distinction breaks down. There's no difference between you and the world, you could say. And then people understand that differently. They understand it, what happened differently. Some people emphasize the sense of plenitude. the sense of fullness, the sense of belonging to the great one whole, you see. And then some people emphasize the opposite, the via negativa, they call it in Latin, the negative way. Neti, neti, not this, not that. That's also from the Upanishads. You can't say anything about it. You can't say it's full. You can't say it's empty, really. It's beyond language. And, you know, so emptiness, shunyata, is the Mahayana Buddhist's best kind of description of what you realize when you encounter and merge with ultimate reality. You're merging with emptiness. You're merging with not something, but the absence of something. The absence of anything distinctive. But if you're merging, if you're understanding the mystical experience as the merging with the plenitude, that also is the merging with nothing distinctive. You see? It's not like you're merging with all these different distinctive things. That, you know, oh yeah, I got a lot of things I'm merging with here. All the things in the universe, individually, you know, understood. You're merging with the one. So the one and the zero are the same thing. If you go far enough right, you get to left. You know. So don't get hung up on the words that much, right? Don't get hung up, and certainly I would recommend. Don't think that when they're talking about emptiness, that they're talking about some different kind of thing than what the Sufis are talking about when they're talking about their mystical experience, or the great Upanishadic sages when they're talking about their mystical experience. In different language, you just use different language. But it's the same experience. It's the experience of feeling that the separation between you and the universe has collapsed. And actually, if you study a text like the Uttara Tantra, a Buddhist text like the Uttara Tantra about what Buddhahood is, it's very described in very much the same way. Buddhahood is the universe. It is the cosmos. It is reality. It's not the Buddha that a Buddha is in Buddhahood or something like that. You see, Buddhahood is the whole. Buddhahood is everything. And that's why you can say that, you know, from that perspective, that the teachings of the Buddha are all around us all the time. You know, we were talking about the Nirmanakaya, the emanation form of the Buddha. Well, from the Buddhist point of view, everything is the emanation of the Buddha. From a Buddhist point of view, from the point of view of Buddhahood, there's nothing that is not Buddha. There's nothing that's not the Nirmanakaya of a Buddha. You know the old joke, right, about the Zen monk who went to the temple and you know, pulled down his trousers and started peeing on the image of the Buddha. And the temple priest comes running out and says, "What are you doing, peeing on the Buddha?" He says, "Please show me a place I can pee where there's not the Buddha." The Buddha is everywhere. The Buddha is everything. Buddhahood is everything. Okay, so it's just all different, like, kind of verbal angles, you know, linguistic angles on trying to talk about what cannot be talked about. And that's ultimate reality. Ultimate reality cannot be talked about. I mean, you can try to, like, dance around it or, you know, circumambulate it with metaphor and all like that. But it really, it is, as they say in the ninth chapter, beyond the buddhi, beyond the intellect. The intellect is deceptive. The intellect deceives us because the intellect categorizes things. The intellect puts things into classes and categorizations and stuff. It divides up the world, you know, in a kind of an artificial way. And that's samsara. Samsara is dividing things up as if they were separate from one another, you know, things and beings. So that's the deceptive reality, and ultimate reality is the opposite of that. But they're not talking about two different realities. They're talking about two different understandings of reality. One more thing, and we've got to move on. For people who are not Buddhas, all non-Buddhas, you can only think about one or the other at one time. You can only think about deceptive reality or ultimate reality at one at a time, right? So, you know, we're thinking about deceptive reality all the time and deceived by it. And therefore, we can't think about ultimate reality. Can't really hold the ultimate reality in our minds because we're, you know, thinking about deceptive reality. And then, you know, maybe once in a while, or, you know, hopefully, we have a direct experience of ultimate reality. We lose ourselves in ultimate reality. And when that happens, we can't think about deceptive reality because we're engulfed. We've lost ourselves in the one or in the emptiness or however you want to call it. Buddhas, they say, uniquely see both at the same time, which is why they also say that Buddhahood is inconceivable. Can't think, because we just can't think it. We can't think how we could see the world of appearances and the world of emptiness, the world of oneness at the same time. Impossible, right? Seems impossible to us. So Buddhahood is that ability. Buddhahood is the ability to see the two truths about reality simultaneously. The two truths are about reality. Deceptive reality, what we call deceptive reality because we're deceived by it, and ultimate reality simultaneously and ongoingly and without effort, also they always say. Without effort. It's not like, okay, I'm going to try and give them both now. Okay? Not here. Yeah. It's in both. No, it's spontaneous, without effort, without forethought, without, you know, it's... Here's another way to think about what Buddhahood is, okay? Buddhahood isn't the attainment of anything. It is the merging of your mind with reality as a whole, so that there's no longer any distinction between you and reality as a whole. You become reality. Buddhahood, a Buddha is one who has matched themselves with Buddhahood, which is reality, as it exists in its entirety. So, you know, talk about the ultimate loss of self, loss of ego. I mean, yeah. So, that's enough, man. Intro. All right, ready for some easy stuff now? Verse 45. The authoritative teachings have monkhood as their root, and monkhood alone is shaky ground. For those whose minds are still grasping, nirvana is also shaky ground. So where we left our heroes at the end of last class was a kind of this discussion between Mahayana and Hinayana. And the Hinayana position is, why do I need emptiness? I have the Four Noble Truths, right? So this is what monkhood means, really. The word in Sanskrit is bhikshutva, bhikshuta. Bhikshu means monk, ta means ness. And it's a kind of a technical term for the sanghas of arhats. Arhats are those who have achieved nirvana. The sangha is the community of those who have achieved nirvana, those who have entered nirvana. So, the Hinayana position is, well, that's the kind of ultimate authority. They've reached the final goal. There's no goal higher than that. So the next verses are, you know, again, kind of technical. A Mahayana critique of Hinayana Nirvana. Okay? From the Mahayana point of view, Hinayana Nirvana is not the final end. It's good. You know, nobody's saying Nirvana is bad. You know, it's really good and, you know, it is a Mahayana principle to rejoice about people who have reached the Hinayana goal. So Shantideva is kind of fudging his vow here a little bit. But anyway, he'll do it. For those whose minds are still grasping, nirvana is also shaky ground. So we'll see. What he's going to argue here is that those arhats, those who have reached nirvana, have not put an end to grasping. If liberation occurred because of the elimination of the mental afflictions, that's the definition of nirvana, right? The permanent cessation of mental afflictions. Yeah. If liberation occurred because of the elimination of the mental afflictions, then it would happen immediately from that. As soon as the mental afflictions ceased, then there would be liberation. Liberation here, I think he means, you know, final liberation, ultimate liberation. then it would happen immediately upon that. But karma is seen even in those who are without mental afflictions. Don't hear that very often. Usually hear that karma and klesha go hand in hand. And so if you didn't have klesha, you wouldn't have karma. Klesha means mental afflictions. But karma is seen even in those who are without mental afflictions. Why? Because even those who are without mental afflictions still have a subtle grasping to self. Not a overt, gross grasping, but a subtle grasping to self. Yeah, this is the Mahayana claim. And therefore, with that subtle grasping to self, they're still producing karma. If one contends that there is no grasping as long as there's no craving, then why is there no craving among those who still have delusions, although free of mental afflictions? So that's the key here. They still have, although they are free of mental afflictions, the subtle grasping to self, or here called a delusion, is still present. Craving is caused by feelings, and feelings are still found in such people whose minds dwell on mental objects of one kind or another. So this is another sort of aspect of the critique, Mahayana critique, of Hinayana understanding of nirvana, is that the Hinayana understanding of nirvana emphasizes only the emptiness of self and not the emptiness of phenomena, what's called phenomena, of things. And so here he's saying they still dwell on mental objects, on objects as if they had some kind of reality to them. Without emptiness, so, you know, it's just all kind of technical. It's interesting for Buddha heads, I guess, to think about, like, you know, arguing about liberation. And, you know, we should be so lucky as to have Hinayana, you know, liberation, okay? So nobody gets to feel high and mighty here about, oh yeah, Mahayana practitioners, lousy arhats who've just reached nirvana. But, you know, at the sort of high end of the spectrum, there's fine distinctions to be made. You see this in the Yoga Sutra also, in the third chapter of the Yoga Sutra. Very fine distinctions between meditative states. Yeah. Without emptiness, the mind is imprisoned. So this is why he's you know, making this argument, because he really Shantideva really wants to say that it's emptiness that pushes you into the final liberation. Okay, and without emptiness, it's always going to be penultimate, not quite there. And emptiness both of self and of the world. So both anatman, every Buddhist school agrees on anatman, that there is no self, no me. But then there's arguments as to whether the world, the phenomena outside of me, something they call it me and mine, me and phenomena, whether phenomena have any kind of reality. And that's kind of like the basis for all the kind of distinctions in the Buddhist schools, actually, pretty much. See, everyone except for the Madhyamakas, for the, you know, the middle way school of philosophy, says that outside phenomena must have at least some kind of existence. It can't be like entirely empty. Even the mind-only school we saw, right? The mind-only school is saying, well, external phenomena, which are kind of projections of the mind, are reflections of something that has some kind of true existence, the mind. Right? So Shantideva represents the school started by Nagarjuna and so forth that radically argues that nothing has any kind of true or self-existence, including emptiness itself. Okay, there's just no ground, nothing to hang on to, no parachute. Nothing has any independent existence whatsoever. And therefore, everything exists only interdependently, including emptiness. What does emptiness exist dependent on? something that is empty. Right? So when you say deceptive reality and ultimate reality, these are two sides of the same coin because they depend on each other. Deceptive reality depends on emptiness to be what it is. If it weren't empty, for example, if the teacup weren't empty of changelessness, of permanence, it's empty of permanence. If it weren't empty of permanence, it couldn't be what it is, which is what? A changing thing. You see, so emptiness makes possible the world around us. If things had what they call self-nature, self-nature means like true existence, independent existence, they could never interact with one another. They could never change. They could never function. Everything would just be frozen in time and space, you know, in these sort of like discrete entities that have, you know, this self-nature. So deceptive reality depends on emptiness to be what it is, to be changing, constantly interacting interdependently with other entities and so forth. But emptiness also depends on deceptive reality to be empty, because there can't be just free-floating emptiness. There has to be the emptiness of something that is empty. Okay? And that's what it means in the Heart Sutra when it says, form is emptiness and emptiness is form. Form is emptiness and emptiness is form. Okay? So, where were we? Without emptiness, the mind is... So now he's getting on 49 is like why he did these other verses. Without emptiness, the mind is imprisoned and arises again, as in the case of non-conceptual meditative states. So, you know, he's admitting that, you know, you can get very, very deep non-conceptual meditative states, but the mind will come back again. The imprisoned mind, the deceptive mind, emerges out of that more or less unchanged. You know, you just like got a big deep sleep, meditative deep sleep. Very relaxing, very good, you know, very still, a lot of shamatha there, you know. But it isn't the same as the meditation direct, especially direct perception of emptiness, which totally changes you. So even in deep meditative states, the mind comes back. The mind's imprisoned. And so, one should meditate on emptiness. And the next couple of verses are just going to underline that. It's very interesting, like, you know, he says this a couple of times, you know, in this. How come he didn't say meditate on emptiness in chapter 8? You know, the whole chapter, the perfection of meditation. You know, you would have maybe thought, well, you know, if emptiness is so damn important, why shouldn't you practice meditating on emptiness? So, just as a guess, okay? First, you have to have the compassion. You see, the meditation in chapter 8 was learning how to feel others as if they were yourself. You know, it was another way of talking about compassion, right? As a prerequisite, as a kind of a sweetening of the mind, so that the emptiness isn't, the perception, the meditation on emptiness isn't dry and selfish, self-centered.
Is the difference between nirvana and full enlightenment that you would go into the direct perception of emptiness with bodhicitta? So then you're cultivating bodhicitta throughout the whole of the eight chapters to go into the direct perception of emptiness.
That's what they say.
Is that the difference?
Well, it puts you on what they call the bodhisattva path. It's the first of the bhumis, the grounds of the bodhisattva, you know, kind of path. And then you go through 10 of those, and then you're in Buddhahood. But yeah, that's the difference. That puts you on the bodhisattva path, is not just seeing emptiness, but seeing emptiness with bodhicitta perfuming the mind. So that sets you off towards Buddhahood rather than to the nirvana he was talking about in these earlier verses. The result of meditating on emptiness is that one stays in samsara. Some people think that this one should be in quotes, you know, like an opponent would say this. I didn't put it in quotes because I think you can justify it as Shantideva's position. The result of meditating on emptiness is that one stays in samsara, in cyclic existence, liberated from clinging and fear for the sake of those who are suffering due to delusion. So that's the bodhisattva ideal, actually, is not to opt out of samsara, but to stay. I mean, you know, there's a whole series, kind of tradition of bodhisattva vows. Different bodhisattvas will take this vow, and they're all of the same nature. There's, I will not go into enlightenment until every other being goes before me. I will stay in samsara until samsara ends. So be the last one to leave the room. Everyone else gets to go first. So I think that's probably what he's indicating here. The result of meditating on emptiness is that one stays in cyclic existence, liberated from clinging and fear. Okay, so it's not like you're affected by samsara. It's in a way you could say it's not really samsara. It's not samsara in the sense of suffering existence, but it's in the sense of community, of interaction with other beings who are suffering, in order to help them. Versus the, sometimes they call it the solitary peace of nirvana. And you know, in many, many Buddhist texts they say, Mahayana Buddhist texts, don't succumb to that temptation of the solitary peace of private nirvana. And I always like wondered, what the hell, what does that mean? Yasami, what? But if you actually go, for example, if you go into long-term retreat, it's really nice. It starts to get really nice in there. And it's like, God, nobody's bugging me. Have no phone calls, no texts. Ah, this is the life, So I think, at a mega level, that's what they're talking about. It'd be really kind of tempting to just say, I got mine. Good luck with the rest of you slobs. This is pretty damn good, though, right? I think we all have some version of that, actually. Because our lives are pretty cushy, aren't they? Anyone think their lives is really difficult? Like to go outside the five-star resort here a little bit and check out what difficult lives look like? So there's a kind of temptation. Kind of temptation is to say, just do it for me. So there is no possible, here comes like one of the typical Shantideva things. Nagarjuna will say things like this too. There is no possible refutation when it comes to emptiness. Nagarjuna says stuff like this, and he says if there was anything that wasn't empty, then you could say that emptiness is refuted. So it's kind of like he's challenging people to like show and tell or something at school. Bring in one thing that isn't empty. And then we'll change everything. Dalai Lama likes to do this too, kind of thing. He says, if science disproves Buddhism, we'll change it. Knowing, of course. There's no way. There's no way that science can disprove, philosophy like this. It's just impossible. Because it's unthinkable. Something that is not empty is unthinkable. Something that's not changing, not empty of change, is almost unthinkable. There's one thing, sometimes they add a couple. Empty space is unchanging. But everything else, you can't even think about what it would mean to say that there's something. Here's some unchanging glasses. These glasses will be here when, the sun supernovas. In gajillions of eons from now. You can't even think of it. You can't think of something that could exist independently and not depend in some way or another on something else. So there's no possible refutation when it comes to emptiness. Therefore, one should meditate on it exclusively and without any hesitation at all. So no fear. Many of the texts also warn, especially teachers, to be careful. Don't teach emptiness to people who aren't prepared for it, because they might freak out or something like that. There's one saying that says when you hear about emptiness, there's kind of two basic responses. Either chills run up and down your spine, going, oh, awesome. Or you get scared to death. Oh my God, you mean things don't exist the way I've always thought they've existed? So, here he's not saying any of that. He says, just go for it. Of course, he's talking to a particular audience here, right? He's talking to presumably to an audience that's like done 8 chapters of his book already. Yeah. Emptiness is the antidote. So it's kind of, he's playing with words here, just, for this people, one person in the room who knows some Sanskrit. In the first verse, 54 there, he's saying there's no refutation, there's no paksha, there's no paksha dushanam. Dushanam means, counter. Paksha means a position in Sanskrit. It literally means a wing, like a bird has a paksha. It's 2 pakshas, hopefully. And then the next, emptiness is the antidote, the pratipaksha. Emptiness is the pratipaksha for the obstacles to omniscience and for the mental affliction obstacles. So those educated Buddhists in the room, Mahayana Buddhists, know that these are the 2 obstacles that have to be overcome to achieve full Buddhahood. When the omniscience, the obstacles to omniscience are finished, then the Dharmakaya of a Buddha arises, the mind of a Buddha, the truth body. And when the mental affliction obstacles are overcome, then the other 2 bodies, the form body, the 2 types of the form body of a Buddha arise. So you could say, like, this is very technical, and I don't want to, it's a whole other course for sure. But the obstacles to omniscience are not, it seems, something that you acquire. The overcoming of the obstacles to omniscience is not something that you acquire. You overcome those obstacles by stop grasping to them, by just realizing that they are like clouds passing through a clear blue sky. So the clear blue sky doesn't have to be built at all. And then the form body, the appearance of a Buddha, is the result of the collection of merit that comes from overcoming the mental affliction obstacles. It's very difficult, very technical stuff, but it seems like that. It seems like that's what they mean. Anyway, so in all cases, emptiness is the antidote to the obstacles to Buddhahood. So meditate on it. Why wouldn't one who wants omniscience immediately begin meditating on it? Anyone want omniscience here? Yeah. I mean, sarvajna means you know everything. You know everything. And, I've struggled with this concept for a decade and a half now, because, I come from the academic world where people want to know everything. No, I mean, you go into the academic world thinking like, this is the goal, I'm going to try to learn everything. And, pretty quickly, you're disabused of that idea. You know the expression, the more you know, the more you don't know? Yeah. The more you know, the more you know what you don't know. Something like that. Yeah. So what the hell does it mean, sarvajna? And there's different understandings of it. There is an argument that a Buddha literally knows everything. And the way I think that argument can be understood is that a Buddha is everything. Okay? It's not like the Buddha and then there's a whole bunch of stuff to know. The Buddha is everything. And then other people argue, what sarvajna means, it's not like, all the names of all the insects on every planet. That's not what sarvajna means. It means all you have to know is how one thing really exists, and then you know how all things exist. And so a Buddha knows how one thing, how everything exists, because they know just, how things exist in general. And any one thing exists in the same kind of way as everything else. It exists deceptively on the one hand, and it exists ultimately on the other. It exists empty, and it exists dependently. And if you know how one thing exists like that, then you just expand it out to everything. Everything exists that way. So why shouldn't you meditate on emptiness? You know, because that will bring you to Buddhahood and all the kind of perks of Buddhahood, including sarvajna, omniscience. Fear arises when one encounters something that produces suffering. Fear arises. And something that produces suffering primarily is ignorance. We suffer because we are ignorant of how things really exist. You know, the word is avidya, not knowing, but it really means thinking that you know something, but it's wrong. You know, because we think we know how things exist, right? We think that, you know, things have some kind of durability, that things have some kind of independent nature and so forth, but we're absolutely wrong about it. So avidya means not so much not knowing, but knowing totally incorrectly. So fear arises when one encounters something that produces suffering. Emptiness pacifies suffering. Emptiness pacifies fear, which comes, you know, suffering and fear. So what is there to fear from it? Fear ignorance. Ignorance is the cause of, you know, of fear and suffering, not emptiness. So it's kind of like giving a little advertisement for why you should continue on in this chapter. Okay? You want to be done with suffering, you want to be done with fear. You want to stop having a bad life. Figure out emptiness. So the next section is called the emptiness of the self. And, it's kind of interesting that it comes right after this verse about fear and suffering, because it's grasping to the self that causes all, is the cause of all fear. All our fear comes because we are grasping to the self. So if there isn't a self to grasp to, then what is there to fear? So here we go. The emptiness of you. Say your name to yourself. If there was anything whatsoever we could call an I, a me, then fear could arise from any object. You know, oh my God, you know, I might run into a chair. Ah, you know, I might stub my toe, you know. I might run into somebody who says some nasty thing about me. See, if there was an I, there'd be all kinds of things that we fear. Have you noticed?
Yeah.
We're fearful beings, aren't we? Really fearful beings. So another way to think about the goal of a spiritual life is to achieve abhaya. Abhaya means no fear. Wouldn't that be nice? And not that stupid no fear of, you know, idiots, you know, in extreme sports or in pickup trucks with, you know, guns, you know, stuff. In America, you see plenty of that. Like, you know, guys with big pickup trucks with guns mounted and they got a bumper sticker, no fear. That's not abhaya. Abhaya says that perfect peace, right? Nothing to fear. Being the friend of everyone. Huh? Nothing to fear whatsoever. Which is kind of what Maitri means, actually. Right? Maitri comes from loving kindness, they translate it as. It really comes from a word mitra, which means friend. Friend to everyone. And regarding everyone as a friend. Not fearing anything from anyone, and not being the cause of fear to anyone. So if there was anything whatsoever we could call an I, then fear could arise from any object. But if there's no self at all, who will there be who fears? So, you know, right off the bat here, he's kind of like saying, okay, so wouldn't that be nice? Now let's persevere and show how there is no self. You know, I think probably doing the same kind of thing that I mentioned the Dalai Lama often does. You know, advertisements at the very start for what you're going to get out of this deal. If you persevere and like really kind of grasp, so to speak, that there's nothing to grasp to, that there's no I, then here's what you'll get out of it. Fearlessness. Because who will there be to fear anything? Because there's no real self here. So these kinds of discussions about no self always involve resistance. Okay? You know, because the phantom self in there puts up a big fight. And, you know, lots of, like, little objections. Most of the objections, I think, are, we can't really sort of answer that now, but there's got to be some loophole. We'll figure it out later, how I actually really do exist. So like anything that's difficult, remember what the reward is. The reward of really grasping the fact that there is no self the way you think that there is happiness and fearlessness. Living happily in the world, because nothing can hurt you, because there isn't a you to hurt. The I is not the teeth, hair, nails, bone, blood, mucus, phlegm, pus, or lymph. Typical Buddhist thing, right? They go through all of the nasty parts of the body. Parts that you didn't even know existed, you know, like fluids in there that you didn't even know. What is lymph? We know what mucus is, I guess. So what he's doing here is starting a section here on how the I, the self that we think exists, is not found in the body or any of its parts. Can't find it in the physical body or any of its parts. It is not the marrow, sweat, fat, or entrails. It is not the cavity of the entrails. It's not the feces or the urine. The eye is not the flesh, the ligaments, nor is it the heat or wind elements. It is not the bodily apertures, nor the six consciousnesses. Five consciousness, sense conscious, plus the consciousness of mind. So then he turns to... Is that true, by the way? Is the eye found anywhere in the body? Or any of the parts of the body? Is it found? It's not found in any one of the parts, right? Because then you could say the eye is my finger, and if I cut off my finger, I wouldn't be an eye anymore. Right? It's not in any of the parts. But isn't it in all the parts put together? The body, isn't it all? Well, why not? Well, there's a mind, for one thing, right? You're not just your body. If you were just your body, you'd be a zombie. You know, because you wouldn't have a mind. You'd be a Walking Dead, Night of the Living Dead, or whatever that is. So now it goes into the eyes not found in the mind, or any of its parts. He uses the example of the awareness of sound, shabda jnana, the awareness of sound. So, you know, there are six awarenesses, actually. There are six awarenesses. The five physical awareness, awareness of sight, of visual objects, of smelly things, etc. And then there's the awareness of what's going on in your mind. If awareness of sound were the eye, then one would always be hearing. If I was the awareness of hearing sound, if awareness of sound, then as long as there's an I would be hearing, because that's who the I is, the awareness of sound. So what's wrong with that? Before you even read on, what's wrong with that? We're not always hearing stuff, right? Sometimes we see stuff. Sometimes we smell stuff. Sometimes we feel stuff. What's left? Taste stuff. And then who are you? See, if you are the awareness of sound, then you would have to be a different you when you're exercising the awareness of sight, changing you. If awareness of sound were the eye, then one would always be hearing. But without an object of knowledge, what does one know? And in what sense could it be called an awareness? So this is a preview of an argument he comes back to. If there wasn't a sound to hear, how could there be an awareness of sound? Right? If there wasn't an object of knowledge, what would one know with the knowing capacity? See? So interdependence. If awareness were unknowing, then a stick would have it. If the awareness existed apart from the awareness of something, then you wouldn't. Then even an inanimate object could have awareness, right? Because it wouldn't require awareness of something. You okay with that? it wouldn't be dependent on anything. Awareness itself, awareness of sound, awareness of sight, awareness of, you know, of a knowable object, wouldn't depend on sound or a visible object or the object that is known. It could just be independently existing, and therefore even an inanimate object could have it because, you know, they're not interacting with anything. Therefore, it is certain that when there is no object of knowledge, there is no awareness. When there's no jneya, it's hard to say, J-N-E-Y-A, which means something to be known. There can't be any jnana. There can't be any awareness of it. Why does one who is aware of form, so now he's talking about the seeing, being able to see, the visual awareness, why doesn't one who is aware of form not also hear it? Because, and then in quotations, here's the answer from the, you know, the imaginary opponent. Because if sound is not present, then there's no awareness of it. It can make sense, right? If it's not present. How could that which consists of the apprehension of sound also be that which apprehends form? Can the eye be both the apprehension of sound and the apprehension of form? Can it be both the hearing capacity and the seeing capacity? The father might be imagined to be the same as the son, but it is not really true. They are two different things, aren't they? The consciousness of visual objects, the awareness of visual objects, is different than the awareness of audible objects. So if you say that the eye is one or the other, then you're not talking about a single eye. Talking about multiple eyes. Switching, every time you switch sense organ, sense power, you become a different person. If you locate the eye in one or another of the sense powers. Just as purity, activity, and sluggishness, here referring to the three gunas of the Sankhya tradition, are neither father nor son, so too is there nothing with the self nature adhering to that which apprehends sound. Nothing with the self nature in the consciousness of sound. Why? Consciousness of sound, the awareness of sound, has no self nature. Why? Because it depends on the sound for it to be there. There can't be an apprehension of sound without a sound that you are apprehending. Right? Mm-hmm. We've gone through this before, right?
Yeah.
And so you can do it the other way. What's the rest of the whole thing? And there can't be a sound until and unless there's somebody who hears it. Neither can exist without the other. So neither can exist independently. And so then tries it again. So, you know, he's talking about like switching from one kind of consciousness to another. Consciousness of sight, consciousness of visual objects, consciousness of audible things and so forth. If it is like an actor taking one guise and then another, like Shakespeare said this, isn't it? All of life is a stage and we're just actors upon it. So if we're just kind of like going through these different roles, now I'm a hearer, now I'm a seer, now I'm a thinker, you know, going through these different roles. If it's like an actor taking one guise and then another, then it's not permanent. So now he turns to the other kind of aspect that we, of the self we think we have. It's the unchanging, permanent self. He says, well, if you're shifting around like that with who you think you are, then how can you say it's a permanent self? It's constantly changing. If it really takes on another self nature, so if it really becomes a different self, if it becomes one kind of self when it's hearing, and a completely different kind of a self when it's seeing, then he says, the so-called oneness of that self is quite extraordinary. You can't say it's one. You can't say it's a unitary self. So it's not permanent if you're switching back and forth, you know, from one consciousness to another, one kind of consciousness to another. And it can't be a unitary self if you really become different selves every time you exercise a different kind of consciousness. If another guise is not the true one, then say what the innate form is. If it's all just role-playing, who's playing the role? You see? And if it's nothing but role-playing, then how can you say there's an unchanging or permanent self if it's really just role-playing? And if it's not just really, if it's only just role-playing, who's playing the role? Who is it that shifts from being a hearer to then being a seer to then being a feeler and then being a taster? If you say it's awareness, if you say it's sort of like pure awareness or something like that, then he says, then all human beings are exactly alike because all human beings have exactly the same pure awareness. Pure awareness means the capacity to be aware. The capacity, not to be aware of something, but the capacity to be aware of anything without being aware of any particular thing. So the awareness of particular things distinguish us as beings, right? Because we're aware of different things at different times, constantly, right? They also distinguish us, like, over time. You know, we change over time. So we say, if you say it's pure awareness, then all human beings are alike. Then he says something a little bit difficult to understand. That which has volition, chetana, it also means consciousness or understanding. And that which does not have volition would be identical because they would have the same reality. I think this is hearkening back to the earlier verse where he says, if you are not aware of something, then you could say that a being who has consciousness and a being who doesn't are and an entity that doesn't are pretty much the same. Like a stick is the same as a person because a person becomes a person when they are aware of something. Sticks aren't aware of anything, and if you're not aware of anything, you're just like a stick. Something like that. If difference falls in, let's skip the rest of that. That which is without consciousness. So now he tries a different angle on it. That which is without consciousness is not the I. Okay? Nobody really thinks that, right? When we're thinking about ourselves, we don't think of an entity that doesn't have consciousness, that doesn't have a mind. That which is without consciousness is not the I. If it were, then it would be something like a piece of cloth, which is also without consciousness. And if it were something that had consciousness, then it would follow that when it was unlinked from the object of consciousness, it would cease to be. So if it were, for example, if I say I am my awareness of knowable things, I am a knower. Isn't that what kind of Descartes said? I think, therefore I am. I think, therefore, cogito ergo sum. I think, therefore I am. If that were the case, whenever I stopped thinking, I would stop existing. In deep sleep, I would just evaporate. No, I mean, we don't think in deep sleep, do we? Not thinking conceptual thoughts, certainly, right? So if we were something that had consciousness, then it would follow that when it was unlinked from the object of consciousness, it would cease to be. So you can pick any one of the six consciousnesses and run the same argument. If you were the consciousness, visual consciousness, being aware of visual objects, as soon as you closed your eyes, you would cease to be. Right? If you were the consciousness of sound, as soon as you went like this, then we would stop existing anymore. And like that. And also with the knowing, the mental consciousness. As soon as, if somebody conked you on the head and, or TKO, you know, punched you in the head and you went unconscious, then you would die. Literally. Every experience of unconsciousness would be death. Because the I would then be tied to the mental consciousness. If the self is unchanging, so now he's going to argue against an unchanging self. If the self is unchanging, what could its consciousness be conscious of? Every time we are conscious of something, of any object, of the five senses including, and the sixth sense also conscious of a thought, we change. Every time we are conscious of something, we change slightly. So an unchanging self wouldn't be able to be conscious of anything because it would be unchanging. If such were the possible, then even empty space. So, well, let's say there was an unconscious, unchanging self. Then empty space could be said to have a self. Empty space is unchanging. Okay, what does that mean? The location that these glasses are in now. Okay, this is the only way that you can really conceptualize empty space. You have to do it. What do you call it? Inferentially, I think. Deductively or something. So, the glasses are in a place right now, right? They're in a space right now. That space, when you take the glasses away, out, that's the only way they can really conceptualize what empty space is. You have to, like, first think about a space that's filled and then take the thing that's filling it out of it. That space, empty space, where things, you know, find location, is unchanging. Unchanging. The sun can supernova, and this space will not change. Okay? Unchanging. So if the self, if you say, well, the self is an unchanging thing, then Shanti Davis says, well, why doesn't empty space have a self then? Because self, empty space is certainly an unchanging thing. But without a self, there is nothing that joins the act and the consequence of the act, says the opponent here. If the actor is destroyed when he or she has completed the act, then for whom will there be a consequence? So now he's talking about karma, the problem of karma, the problem of karma over time. Is the person who created the karma, who does the act, the same person who reaps the consequence of the act later? If it's a changing self, you can't say it's the same person, right? And everyone's pretty much agreed that the self is changing. So then how do you justify, you know, the karmic principle? If it's not you that receives the result, it's not the same you that receives the result as you created in the past, then in what sense is there a karmic kind of connection between cause and effect? He says, well, you know, everyone agrees on this. We too have agreed that there are different bases for the act and for the consequence. Different bases, different, you know, kind of basis of the self. So the body-mind complex at one point, at the point of cause, is not the same body-mind complex at the point of result. You know, everyone's agreed on that. And that the self has the self has nothing to do with it. There's obviously no continuous self like that, that's unchanging over time. It is apparent that the one who creates the cause and the one who experiences the result do not exist at the same time. It's obvious. It's apparent. I once, was teaching in Germany, wearing Buddhist robes and everything at a yoga studio, and some German got in my face about this. You know, oh, you Buddhists, you know. What about this? What about, you say everything's changing, you say there's no self and like that. Well then, how does karma work? How could karma possibly work? There's not, you know, not the same person at the time of the cause as you are at the time of the result. As if like that clinched things. Well, Buddhists say that too. There's no Buddhist who says that the self is the same at the time of cause as it is at the time of result. It's apparent, he says here. It has been demonstrated that the agent and the recipient are linked by a unity of the continuum. Those of you who were at the teachings at Oasis Holistic, you know, on Nagarjuna on the emptiness of causation, you know, he goes into this whole thing. The continuum, santana. So there's a continuum. There's not a self that unchangingly, like, remains, you know, constant from the time of cause to the time of effect. But there's a continuum of moments. There's a continuum of the process, you could say, the karmic process. So there's no I there. There's no I there. It's just a process. Just a, you know, kind of two different points on a spectrum, on a scale that are linked by points in between. Although Nagarjuna says that's not even possible either. The eye is not the mind. So now this is a very interesting argument about why there isn't an eye. When would there be an eye? If there was an eye, like we think it exists, when would that happen? The eye is not the mind of the past, nor the future. Why? Past and future don't exist. Past is gone, and future hasn't come yet. So that only leaves one more time for the eye. No, the present. So if the eye were the present mind, then when the present mind ceased to be, the eye would no longer exist. So if you locate the eye in the present, then as soon as the present becomes the past, then you are no more. And when does the present come to the, when does the present become the past? As soon as you say it. I mean, not even, right? Before that. If there is no living, if just as there is nothing inside, did I say inside in the final translation?
Yeah.
There is nothing inside when you cut into the tree of a banana tree, trunk of a banana tree. You guys out here in the tropics know, I guess, this better than we do. That the banana tree is empty in the middle somehow, right? Is it?
Hollow.
Hollow. Just as there is nothing when you cut into the trunk of a banana tree, so too when you go looking systematically for the eye, there is nothing that exists. Then the argument comes back. If there is no living being, for whom will we have compassion? So if there's no eyes, if there's no real beings, no real selves, who should I have compassion? You're telling me I should have compassion. You did this whole big, like, 8 chapters on how we should, you know, have compassion for other suffering sentient beings. But now you're telling me that there's nobody there. I'm not there, and no suffering beings are there, so for whom shall I have compassion? Very interesting answer to this. It is for the one we imagine because of our delusion and accept for the sake of the work to be done. You should have compassion for imaginary beings. And we should act in the world compassionately because that's what it is to do. Like a dream. You should have compassion for the beings in your dream who are suffering. So you're having a dream where people are, you know, sick, poor, you know, dying and so forth. You should have compassion for them. And in your dream, you should work for them. You should try to help them in your dream. But it's just a dream. Just because it's a dream doesn't mean it doesn't have a certain kind of reality. Yeah. Because of our delusion. All appearances are illusory. All appearances by nature are illusory. Because they appear one way and they are not that way. So he said, well, that's okay. Function, the illusion functions, and therefore exercise compassion for illusory suffering beings. Just like in a dream. The Avalokiteshvara, the one who sees and does not see. Who sees that beings are suffering and does not see that they are really suffering simultaneously. But if there are no living beings, whose work is it? So who's going to exercise? If there's no suffering beings, if there's no real beings, then who should I exercise compassion towards? And then if there are no helpers, real helpers, who's going to do the work of exercising compassion? It is true that the effort is also characterized by delusion. It is true that trying to help other beings, exercising compassion towards other beings, is also illusory. It is true. But delusion, when it comes to work done for the purpose of the cessation of suffering, should not cease. Very interesting. Very interesting. Just because it's illusory doesn't mean you should stop doing it in this case. Should not cease. Ignorance about the delusion should cease. But the dream shouldn't cease. You see? Ignorance about the fact that you are dreaming should cease. But the dream should not cease, and your activity, benevolent activity within the dream should not cease. Get the distinction? You're not looking like it. Should I say it again? Okay, all right, that's good enough. Then, because in the last one he says here, But if the ego, the ahamkara, which is the cause of suffering, enlarges because of the delusion of the self, then so as not to have that happen, a meditation on no self is best. So he ends this little section by saying, look, you should exercise compassion, even though it's illusory, even though the self that is suffering, the selves that you're exercising compassion towards are illusory, and the one who's exercising the compassion is also illusory, you should like act as if it weren't in a way. You should act as if it weren't. But then he says, but if that increases your sense of self, if that increases your grasping to self, increases the ego, then stop and do a no-self meditation. So this is why, in Mahayana Buddhism, they say there has to be two wings to the practice. There's compassion and there's wisdom. And when one or another gets too strong, you balance it out with the opposite. You'll find, I think, if you watch your practice, that one or another tends to overweigh the other. You come to a retreat on the ninth chapter of the Guide to the Bodhisattva's Way of Life, and the wisdom thing, might get like a little bit enlarged. It grows. And then the compassion gets a little, so then you might want to balance it out with a lot more heart practice and a little less wisdom practice, and keep the kind of thing like that. Like with driving a car, with the accelerator and the brake, so that you're keeping a kind of an even keel, an even speed. So this is a very interesting kind of way of talking about those two wings. Saying, exercise compassion. Even though things are empty, even though there are no real selves, no real suffering beings, or no real sort of exercisers of compassion, still do it. But then if like you forget that there really are no self-existently suffering beings, and if you forget that there is no self who exercises, then go back to the no-self meditation. Go back to the wisdom side and keep that balance there. All right. What's the exercise, Cindy? Thank you. The section of the text deals with the emptiness of the self. Carve out some time each day this week to review the arguments for why an I cannot be found in the physical body and the awareness of the data the sense organs relay. Then review the subsequent arguments for why the self cannot be unitary and unchanging, and cannot be found in the past, future, or even present. So this section is really kind of a comprehensive argument, in a fairly succinct way, on all the reasons why the self that we think exists cannot possibly exist. Cannot possibly exist. There is a self that exists, okay? It exists in the same kind of way that everything else does. How? As a changing thing, as an impermanent thing, as a thing that depends on other things. But there is no independent, unchanging, unitary self. That's the argument. And that's the self that we're clinging to. If you say that over and over again, like I have in teachings for years and years, you might fool yourself into believing that you actually believe that. That you really believe, of course I know that there's no independent, unchanging, unitary self. But as soon as you stop saying it, you start clinging to it again. It is very deeply held belief. So the argument has to be, kind of gone over and over and over again, especially in meditation, in order to have it sink in even a little bit. I think I've told you, I spend a lot of time translating, texts like this, and really trying to think about what they're saying and all of that. Maybe a couple hours, and you're just like sitting there, I think I got it now, what he's trying to say. And as soon as you stop, it's like it never happened. So get up from the desk, and like life just goes on just as it did before you sat down to do it. It's very depressing in a way. Yes. No. How hard... The wood is, how hard it is to get through in that. And so it's not just an intellectual party game. It's not just a clever thing, you know. If it's going to have any impact on your life, it has to be reviewed over and over and over and over again. And really intellectually first and foremost, because if you don't believe it, then you can't really meditate on it. You know, meditation, some forms of meditation are helpful in this way, analytical meditations, where you're turning it over in your mind, you know, in a very kind of concentrated way. But I think even outside of meditation is necessary before the meditation's really going to have any deep impact. To sit down and meditate on the absence of self, you have to have first convinced yourself that this is a legitimate thing to meditate on. You know, that it's not just like something that somebody else said that, you know, maybe you think that you should meditate on. You have to convince yourself that it's impossible. It's impossible to believe in what we believe in 24/7. It just makes no sense, logically. So that's the advantage of going through a text like this, you know, and really, really struggling with it and really working with it intellectually is, you know, to try to break through the deep, 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 deep levels of denial, actually. We're in denial. We're in denial that we're not there in the way that we think that we are. We're in denial that it's only a dream. It's only a dream. It's like a dream. You know, old people say this, right? You know, if you talk to really old people who know that they're dying, you know, who know that they've only got like months, years at most to live, say, just goes by like that. Just like that. Right? Like a dream. Just like that. And all our lives are like that. It will be that way for everyone. Just like goes by like that. And then we get all attached to it, though, you know? And we suffer instead of, like, you know, living freely and happily. We suffer because we are attached to the idea that it isn't a dream. It's got real, you know, it really is a big problem here. What that boss said to me, you know, it's really a problem. And it's like, it's just like it's ephemeral, like smoke and mirrors. Like steam rising and then like fading away, yeah, like that. And if we truly understood that, we'd live a lot happier lives, wouldn't we?
Yes.
Yes. Free and happy. What could disturb you then? That's what he started out the whole section with. If you really understood the fact that the self that we are defending and trying to aggrandize and increase and so on isn't even there. If we really understood that, how much happier we would be. How much less turmoil and suffering and fear would we have? So work on it. It's important to try to work on it.